What opera is to musical comedy, Wagner's Ring Cycle is to opera. It's bigger, grander, and an inspiration to a fanatical group of devotees. So when Peter Gelb, the Metropolitan Opera's general manager, commissioned Robert Lepage to stage a radically new production of this formidable masterpiece, it was clear that the backstage drama, trials, and triumphs would rival those on the stage. A documentary film that chronicles that process, called Wagner's Dream, was 5 years in the making and concludes with the productions of the four epic operas. I'm very pleased that it brings filmmaker Susan Frumke and Peter Gelb to our show now to talk about it. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Peter, just to get this out of the way, did anyone question your sanity when you agreed to Robert Lepage's plan?
No, I don't think anybody questioned it at the time. I think they've questioned it since.
And what about you? Did you question it?
No, he was actually my first choice and only choice because I've known his work for about 20 years, and I think he's absolutely brilliant, and I was thrilled that he agreed to do it.
Now, Susan, you seem to be there from the start. How early in this whole process did you get involved?
Pretty much at the very beginning. I think the only thing I missed was the initial meeting between Robert and his set director, Carl Filion. It was tremendous access, actually. We started when they just made the smallest scale model up in Quebec City, which is where Robert is from and where the Ex Machina team operates out of.
This expensive, incredible set that is at the center of the story.
Right, exactly. Well, when we first saw it, it was like little, almost like popsicle sticks, you know, moving back and forth when they were kind of trying to figure out the idea. And over the course of the film, you see it really grow and evolve.
Well, Peter, wasn't Lepage's plan incredibly expensive? How much did his radically different set compare in cost with and development from previous sets for the Ring Cycle?
Well, actually, it is somewhat misleading. I mean, the set has become, you know, so infamous and so much reported about that it's sort of taken on a gigantic life of its own. But in
fact, almost Wagnerian.
It's Wagnerian. Everything about this project is Wagnerian. But in fact, the set itself is really no more expensive than four productions, which The Ring is. You know, it's four very long operas, and Robert's genius idea was to have this incredibly flexible stage machine that is incredibly difficult, but I think by now we have mastered it. But this one machine serves all four operas, every scene of the four operas. So if you divide it into four parts, it actually is equal to four expensive standard opera productions.
Well, it has to be there for all four because it's incredibly difficult to get onto the stage at the Met. Once it's there, you don't want to take it away for a while.
It is incredibly difficult. It was, you know, as Susan's film documents and has been reported in newspapers, it weighs about twice as much as it was supposed to weigh when we first planned it.
And was the stage okay? Or did you have to put special buttressing in?
We had to put special steel girders underneath the underside of the side stage, where it sits on a stage wagon, one of the movable surfaces that moves onto the stage. But you know, with each challenge, Robert and his team and the Met's technical team rose to meet these challenges, and you know, I was determined not to let anything prevent this from happening.
Well, Robert Lepage was quoted as saying that he couldn't refuse your offer to do this because you had the resources to produce his vision. So he had already imagined something like this?
I don't think he imagined it.
He hadn't done opera before.
No, he had done opera before. I mean, I was, you know, as I said earlier, I was very familiar with his work.
I thought it was Cirque du Soleil mostly.
No, Cirque du Soleil came much later in his career. Although he grew up with, he was busking on the streets of Quebec City with Guy de Liberté, who founded Cirque du Soleil. But in fact, Robert was a very distinguished director of theater and an actor himself. Long before Cirque du Soleil found him, and he had directed several operas, including a dramatic production of Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, which I commissioned him to do back in 1991 or two. So I've known him for a long time and admired his work.
Is it even possible to do a small Ring Cycle? You can do Aida without the elephants, but Wagner seems to require a grandeur that can't be faked. Can a small company do the cycle credibly?
I don't think it's possible to do it as Wagner intended. And that was the whole point of Robert's vision for this piece. And certainly it's the Met's intention. You know, Wagner's...
Well, Wagner has people flying.
Wagner has people flying. He has all kinds of... In his original plans for The Ring, which were never realized when he first presented The Ring, as is pointed out in Susan's film, he has all these amazing things that have to take place, which normal stagecraft and technology can't accommodate. So Robert's vision was to actually present a ring that could realize all of Wagner's stage instructions in the score. And that's really what this ring has done, with a lot of difficulty, but it's amazing. It's nothing like it has ever been seen on the stage of the Met before, I can say that.
Susan, how familiar were you with Wagnerian opera before you took on this project?
I had seen the Otto Schenk production, the entire Ring cycle, in, I think, in 1990, 91. But I didn't really understand the different layers that you can get into Wagner when you really study it. And I know there are people who have spent their entire lives studying the Ring, and it was one reason why I wanted to take on the project, because I wanted to immerse myself in the Ring.
So you were not only recording what was going on, you were also learning about the whole process of this opera.
Oh,
from
absolutely.
Wagner's point of view to the way it's been produced since.
Absolutely. I mean, any time that a new Ring production comes out, you know, it's kind of it's really something that everybody looks forward to in the cultural world, and there are a lot of precedents. And I think what's different about the Lepage attempt is he really did try to stage the unstageable parts of Wagner's libretto, and a lot of the film deals with some of those.
Well, Peter, because opera is so often tradition-bound, is it fair to say that most risk-takers don't gravitate toward it as a profession?
Well, I've tried to change the culture of the Met to make it a warm and friendly place for creative risk-takers, and I've taken a certain number of risks in making the Met a place where directors like Lepage would want to work and will feel welcome.
And you... I'm sure you expected the kind of outrage that some people expressed.
Well, you know, I really do not court controversy. It seems to be a natural byproduct of this process, but it was certainly not my intention. What we set out to do was to create a ring that would please the public.
Well, Susan, the fans become characters in this movie.
Yes, they do. And it's interesting because when we filmed the opening day of the box office for the 2010-11 season, and I had heard a lot about these ring nuts, you know, what people call ring nuts, people who live and breathe the Ring cycle, and sure enough, they were all there, you know, when we first started filming. And a lot of them were very worried about the production, but...
They'd heard rumors, and they were already critical.
Because, you know, it is funny how this kind of subset of people do like to kind of hold on to a ring that they love. But at the end, it was actually... I was surprised at how many of them came over and really embraced this.
One of the fans you interviewed confessed to having seen The Ring 35 times.
I know. It's
and there was a couple where he seemed to be incredibly critical, and then later he kept on softening more and more. Perhaps, Peter, you won those people over.
Well, I'd like to think that we have won over the majority of the public. I know that there are people who don't like this production, but, you know, when you have a 3,800-seat opera house, it's impossible to please everyone all the time. We want to please most of the people most of the time, and I believe the audience, if last night was any test, we had a performance of Siegfried, the audience was adoring it. And
well, but they know what to expect now.
They know what to expect, and... I think that also the performers and the technical team, everyone is much more comfortable with the scenic machine, and it flows much more fluidly.
Yeah, so you don't have some of the glitches you had in the past. Have you spoken to Julie Taymor about that process?
Well, Julie actually is a big fan of opera, and she was in the audience last night. In fact, somebody who also, like Robert Lepage, likes to, you know, push the theatrical envelope and is so original in her theatrical thinking that she comes up with things that people have never seen before.
Considering all of the problems that occurred along the way until things were worked out, you'd think that there would be that the crew would be a lot less civilized than it turns out to be? Or did you cut out some of the angrier moments? Did you cut out some of the diva breakdowns?
Actually, no, we didn't. The truth is that it was a very hardworking group. I mean, there was a spirit of this was an extremely ambitious undertaking, and everyone wanted to make it work. So there was a learning curve that happened when the machine finally arrived at the Met, and kind of Ex Machina and Robert had to hand it over to the Met technical staff. And, you know, it was just a learning process, really. But it actually went very smoothly once they really got the first one under their belt. After Das Rheingold, to my eye, it looked like everything started to smooth out. But I will say this, is that there was also another learning curve when the singers showed up, too, because they had to start to become comfortable with it, and they did.
Mm-hmm. Although there were a few mishaps. But it's really interesting some of the other stuff that shows up. For example, Brian Terfel tells a story about Pavarotti's rituals and then performs it himself. We learn about the superstitions of opera singers, some of the things that we may not be aware of otherwise.
Well, you know, singers are you have to forgive singers for all their superstitions and all the anxiety that they go through, because I don't know any performing art that puts as much pressure on the artists as opera does. You know, they're on the stage, unhelped by microphones or any, you know, as much modern technology that has gone into this production. Singers rely upon their vocal cords and air passing through their throats to produce musical sounds. And Wagner is more demanding on the singers than any composer, and The Ring is more demanding than any opera.
We're talking about a new film called Wagner's Dream, which chronicles the development of the productions of the four epic operas of Wagner's Ring cycle, with Susan Fremke, the filmmaker, and Peter Gelb, the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera Company. The Ring has been described as the most ambitious undertaking any opera company can attempt. So I would assume that there's always a certain amount of nightmare involved.
Well, I think there's the challenges of producing a Ring are, yeah, there's no easy way to do it. And, you know, if we were less ambitious, we would have been accused of not standing up to the plate. So, you know, I don't regret for one moment the course that we took to take on this enormously ambitious project. There's no question we all had our bruises along the way. But I think, you know, going back to the stage crew, I think that they actually, for the most part, really enjoy it, because they normally during an opera, they don't get to do as much. This is a very stimulating process for them. They get to actually interact with this behemoth machine. You know, they have ropes that they have to pull and they attach to it, and it goes through its paces with them, you know, actively involved.
Well, if we think of the Ring cycle as one opera, because it really tells one story.
Right.
They come out, as Lepage points out, of the Nordic Eddas, the Icelandic epic poems, and he says he actually studied them. There are certain surprises. For example, the hero or the heroine doesn't show up until the second opera. Well, and her love, who is so important, doesn't show up until the third opera.
Well, they had a strange sense of pacing back then. You know, it's a 16-hour piece, so I guess you have to leave some room for some surprises.
I did have real sympathy for one of your singers who was terrified standing on the stage when there was a small mishap, and reminds you that good singers aren't so easy to find.
Well, certainly, you know, the singers. One thing, you know, we have to realize, though, in live theater, and particularly on a stage like the Met, accidents, there's always the possibility of an accident happening in any production. You know, right now I just came from a rehearsal of Billy Budd, which is a production that goes back to the late 70s, which has a ship that rises to 5 stories height with singers and supers on the top level of it. So, you know, opera is, is potentially dangerous. Surprisingly so, I guess, for people who don't know it.
Now, Susan, you pretty much followed the development of this set, this huge set. from its beginnings. Did you believe in it from the start? Or did you think, oh boy, what are they getting themselves into?
Yeah, in all honesty, especially once it made it to the Met and you saw how incredibly complicated it was to actually run the machine and all that went into it, and the fact that as opening night approached for Das Rheingold, they had never made it through one full rehearsal, you know, from start to finish. I did wonder what was going to happen.
Well, suddenly the tenor gets sick, and you had to rush in a new tenor who has become a star.
Right. In the case of Siegfried, J. Hunter Morris, who was singing last night and had the biggest ovation of anyone on the stage.
And
overnight, he's become a sensation.
Well, it's so odd to hear him talking in a very strong Texas twang, and then right. Suddenly he goes out on the stage and sings in perfect German.
He's a phenomenon.
One of the wonderful things about the movie is that it how it captured how incredibly large and dramatic and grand the backstage world is. And that's something that you were privy to that the rest of us could not be unless we see a film like this.
Absolutely. And I think, first of all, there's just the mystery and beauty of being backstage and just seeing the lighting and kind of getting glimpses onto the onstage performances. It's really exhilarating. And it's just, you know, as I said, I was given phenomenal access. So nothing was really off limits. We could be in the dressing rooms. We could be backstage. We could be in the boardrooms. It was a phenomenal kind of assignment.
So I'm assuming you shot thousands and thousands of feet of film. When did you realize that you were going to be able to give it some kind of a shape?
That always really takes place in the edit room. But, you know, even though we started really following the LaPage story and the evolution of the machine, giving birth to the machine, I realized quickly when we were filming that this was also a story about the Met's efforts to bring in a new audience and to bring more dramatic productions to the stage. And then we also realized that we were going to be filming Debbie Voigt because she was learning the role of Brunhilde for the first time, which is such a challenge to any soprano, but especially
even though she's a very experienced
but she had never sung this role before.
And so I knew right away that there would probably be three strong storylines that would be interwoven. It's much more than just a, in my opinion, than just a behind-the-scenes film.
And she undermines our vision of divas. She slips and slides on the machine in the very first performance, and she doesn't have a backstage tantrum of the sort that we would have expected from a Maria Callas. So have opera singers changed over the years, or is this just Deborah Voigt?
I think that opera singers fall into different categories. You know, she is I guess what you're saying, in showbiz is a real trooper. I mean, you know, she rises to the challenge, and she was certainly nonplussed by her entry slip, but she got up and she went on, and a lot of the people in the audience, some people realized it looked bad. Other people thought maybe it was something that she had planned.
Did you change the staging?
We didn't change it right away. We did change it this season, the second season. You know, one of the problems with changing stagings in a show is, in an opera, is once the performance production is opened, there's no rehearsal time. You know, we lock the show. This year, when we brought Die Walküre back, we had rehearsal time again, and we did change the staging.
And I mentioned that you lost your tenor, had to have a last-minute replacement who luckily turned out okay. You had other problems. James Levine, your longtime conductor, got sick and had to have surgery.
Well, James has had a lot of medical problems over the last couple of years, and you know, we all very much are sympathize with him, and the orchestra misses him, but we were very fortunate to also have a wonderful replacement for him in Fabio Luisi, who's become our principal conductor.
Still, all of this, at a certain point, did you think, what else can go wrong?
I don't like to think that way, because something will.
Because the point that you keep on making is this is live theater.
Right.
Although there's a wonderful scene where people are watching it in the rain on a big screen in Times Square.
I have to say it's one of the most moving scenes, in my opinion, because it's opening night of Das Rheingold. Everybody's sitting at Times Square because the Met was doing a plaza cast kind of broadcast to bring it free to the public. And no one moves. I mean, it's pouring rain. It's torrential rain. And everybody is just riveted watching the opera. And it's all ages. It's just, I think, a wonderful moment.
What was your reaction to the mixed reviews? They seem to be better the second time around. Do you think that critics also are like those fanatics who have strong opinions, come in expecting something, and then when it doesn't turn out the way they imagined, they write a mixed review?
Well, you know, I certainly respect the critics to have their opinions, but I really can't allow their opinions to guide what I'm doing. I'm trying to, you know, achieve performances and productions that the public will respond to. I think some of the critics have gotten more used to the machine. Some will never get used to it, but that's, you know, that's critics.
Now, the film was shown at the Tribeca Film Festival. How will people be able to see it now?
Well, on Monday, May 7th, it's going to show nationally on the HD broadcast series. Do you want to talk a little about that, Peter?
Well, this is, you know, part of the initiative that we began a couple of years ago, which is to have live transmissions of the Met, and the movie is being shown in accompaniment with the that series on May 7th nationally.
Thank you both so much for being on our show today. Peter Gelb is the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera Company, and Susan Fremke is the filmmaker behind a new film called Wagner's Dream.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.